This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. While you're there, you can also pick up two tickets to my upcoming live show, The Confidence Artist, at Northcote Town Hall from the 4th to the 8th of July. I've been telling everyone that this is a crash course in con artistry, a TED talk for tricksters and a school for scoundrels. Basically, everything you've ever wanted to know about becoming a professional con artist is in this show. So we're going to take you through how to cheat at cards, how to tell really good lies, short cons, long cons. And I've been doing a lot of the material around town at all the various magic nights and comedy nights and speaking engagements and so on. And people have really been responding well to this this new take on what I do. Basically, imagine it's like you've seen a magic trick and then explains how the magic trick works and then how you can use that same magic trick to make an absolute bomb. So that's a confidence artist at the Northcote Town Hall as a part of the Melbourne Magic Festival from the 4th of the 8th of July. I am not a big fan of terms like Western medicine and alternative medicine. Surely there's just medicine that works and medicine that doesn't, and we should be taking the former and not the latter. You shouldn't reject acupuncture because it's some ancient form of alternative medicine that goes against the wishes of Big Pharma. We should reject it because it doesn't work. There's no evidence that says that it does. And yet, what we have is not just two very distinctive types of medicine, we have two very distinctive ways of dealing with sick people. One that exists in a frustratingly impersonal yet effective world of empirical science, and the other that exists in a more romantic sphere that puts the patient's desires front and center, but at the cost of, well, you know, actually working. Why do people seek out the fanciful over the factual when it comes to their health? And what can GPs learn from alternative medicine practitioners that they can use in their day-to-day practices? On this episode of Scammapalooza, Dr. Vyom Sharma talks about working as a GP in a world where homeopaths can sell treatment that contains literally no ingredients, and doctors are tied up with red tape, bureaucracy, laws, and that pesky Hippocratic Oath. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza.
You're a GP. You went through the whole medical degree thing. As I say that, I have no idea what is involved in actually becoming a GP in the modern world. What do you need to become a GP?
So in the old days, all that needed to happen was you went to medical school, you finished, and then you don't pick a specialty and, hey, you're a GP, you're a general practitioner. That's what it used to be, but it's changed a lot now, and really Australia's kind of led the way here, where general practice isn't the thing you do when you haven't got a specialty. General practice is a specialty. So you'll finish your medical degree, 5-6 years, whatever that is, if you're an undergraduate student. You'll do a couple of years work in hospitals called internship or residency or whatever you want to call it.
Now, that's the television show Scrubs.
Do you know what's funny? People bring that up
all
the time.
Not the television show Scrubs. Sorry, go on.
No. Out of all the medical dramas, comedies, whatever you want to call them, that have ever been made about what day-to-day medicine in a hospital is really like, Scrubs is by far and away the most accurate.
That's what everyone has said, that they had a doctor on call, like, who was there to work, but he was a friend of I've forgotten the name of the producer, but the guy who created the show, and it was his mate, and so they would sit and he would, it was the doctor could come in and point stuff out was wrong or make suggestions as a friend as opposed to as an outside consultant, and so because of that it feels more real.
It really shows. Like, when you compare it to other dramas that seem to be a bit more realistic, ER or House or whatever, no, they are not even close to the accuracy in that show. And also just the characters, the same kind of bitter characters, comedic characters. You know, often the guy who looks like the bad guy is the good guy and the good guy is the bad guy. Oh my God, it really resonates so much with anyone who's ever been through medical school. So yeah, good reference.
So you've passed your Zach Braff phase, so you do that, and then what is the next stage?
Right, so the next phase is to choose the specialty you want to go into. So you could become a surgeon, and varying types of surgeons, different types of physicians. You could be an oncologist, etc. But what happens now, and has happened in Australia probably for the last 20 years or so, is you can pick general practice, being a GP, family medicine, whatever you would like to call it, as a specialty. And so you go work in GP clinics for a few years, in a supervised way where you're still a trainee doctor. And you work essentially as a GP and you learn the things that only, I guess, a GP would learn. And it's a funny specialty in that it's probably the only specialty really where not knowing all the answers is literally part of the job requirement. Like, that's what it means to be a generalist. And so one of the most difficult things in those years of GP training is dealing with uncertainty and constantly being in this state of, I don't know. But you know, not knowing what's going on is a very different thing to knowing what's the next correct thing to do. And that's the way we really try to gear ourselves in GP land, I guess. Constantly trying to manage our ignorance and our knowledge and just try to do the next right thing.
But from a patient perspective, I don't want to go and see you and I've got this lump and it's getting bigger and I've got headaches and I've got double vision and I keep passing out on public transport, and for you to go, I don't know. Like, we don't want that. So how do you then handle that as a, when seeing a patient and when you say what to do next, you mean to refer into someone who does? Is that?
Well, or just even knowing what tests to order next until we get a certainty of the diagnosis, or what tests to do next to so we can rule out other causes. Do we wait? Do we just watch it for a while? Do we take out a biopsy of the lesion so we can actually look under a microscope to see what it is? Or should we just hold off? That's what I mean by the next right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Do we try to treat it with something based on a theory and see what happens? So those are like all the separate options, I guess, that are available to patients and their GPs. But you're right. It's incredibly confronting for both patient and doctor, I guess, to have to deal with this relative, I guess, ignorance a lot of the time. Don't get me wrong. Of course, a lot of the time we know exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So a really straightforward case might be, like I said, its simplest would be a cold or a bronchitis or a pneumonia, or someone who's come back with a fever from overseas and you diagnose them with malaria. You know, a GP can be equipped to handle any and all of those things, from the very simple to the complex. But that journey of uncertainty, which happens every day in general practice for a few consultations a day, is difficult. And you really have to try and get the patient on the same side here and really make them understand the landscape you're dealing with. And I've got to say, most of the time, people, if you really explain that to them, cope with it pretty well.
I personally prefer it. I think I told you I went to the doctor a few weeks ago and he just was filled with doubt and did not know, was completely like, just had absolutely no idea. And I found it very very reassuring that he was more than, because when they come to you with certainty, you're like, wait, are you telling me the truth? You're just telling me what I want to hear. But as soon as they say, I don't know, you know they're telling you the truth.
Because that's exactly
I know what's wrong with him, but I'm not going to tell him. I'm going to give it to myself.
You'll find out next consultation.
Yeah, that's right. Next time you'll find out. And that, though, I mean, what you are describing is essentially empirical science.
Yes.
At its core, is that you are presented with, you observe something, you come up with a hypothesis, but that ultimately you don't know, and then you perform a series of tests and analyze those tests and come up with what is hopefully the correct answer, or yes, you find out the hypothesis was wrong and then you start the process all over again. Like, this is that's how science works.
Exactly.
However, from a patient, from a doctor's perspective, that is the, and from, back until the Enlightenment, we know that's how science works, and that's the best way to do science, is to be filled with doubt. But patients often, don't want doubt. They want certainty, and they want answers, and they want the shortest answer, which is, I guess, when people start turning to less scientific, more romantic remedies. Do you think non-scientific medicine or medical treatments have any role to play in the treatment of sick people?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. When you say non-scientific, I guess we're sort of talking about things that haven't been tested at all, or have been tested and not shown to have any kind of benefit.
Let's start with things which just make a claim that they're going to make you feel better, but don't. So let's, that I know better than a placebo. So homeopathy, I know, is one that you have a, you know, that you have been publicly outspoken about in the past, in that homeopathy doesn't work. There was that review of, I think, 1,800 studies, you know, across a million different things, and showed that it doesn't work. It is exactly the same as taking, you know, putting a drop of a homeopathic liquid on your tongue is the same as a drop of water, sure. Literally.
Yeah.
And that there's no active ingredients in most homeopathy. Mm. And yet it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So let's use that as an example. Does something like homeopathy have any role to play?
So it's an interesting question, because I guess a lot of people expect me to say complete and utter 100% blanket no, there is no role to play. Whereas I guess there probably is just a tiny kind of sliver through which I guess I could be persuaded a little bit. But let's talk about the cases where it's definitely not applicable. So I think it's completely inappropriate to use homeopathy as a treatment option when we know there are other treatment options that are conventional and proven to work scientifically that are better. Mm-hmm. So that is just a complete no-no, I suppose, for homeopathy, which is really the bulk of the things it really tries to treat. Then we've got a bunch of conditions where we don't really have the answers in I guess, conventional scientific evidence-based medicine. And no one really does. And then homeopathy claims to be able to treat these things. And that, on one hand, is still a bit of a more of a grey area because, well, it's, you know, realistically, it's not like they have another option, I suppose, a lot of these people. And so what we're really talking about here is it okay to, and I'm going to be as fair as I can when I make this statement, is it fair to lie to people by giving them a false expectation of getting better when they probably won't get better to the extent that they expect to get better? That is to say, is it appropriate to use this treatment as a placebo, really? And what we're talking about here is a pretty small marginal amount of cases. And so that, on the other hand, is a completely different, I guess, ethical question in and of itself. You know, is it perhaps maybe in these 0.1% of cases okay to use homeopathy as placebo when there is just absolutely no other treatments that are going to work? And that's a big ethical question, which I guess I wrestle with all the time, because I guess a lot of what happens in broader medicine as well is there's this placebo response that's kind of inbuilt into a lot of what we do. So, for example, if you have a pneumonia and I give you antibiotics because I think you're going to get better, there is a placebo component at play there too. I don't tell you that when I prescribe it to you, but.
And biologically, though, because we talk about a placebo and everyone knows it means there's no chemical reason why it should work, mm-hmm. or biological, but because we believe it, our body. Now, this is the thing, because a lot of people think that a placebo cures you.
Mm.
And it doesn't necessarily cure you. It releases endorphins that make you feel better, but and it's also, I think, reduces swelling in some cases, but like it doesn't cure what is actually wrong with you, but it acts as a pain relief. Is that an accurate sort of like description of the placebo effect?
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, placebo effect, when it quote unquote cures people, it's really to do with people reporting or believing, I guess, that they are getting better, which is very different to chemically whether things are getting better or not. You know, there's just no way that a sugar pill is going to cause a tumor to regress, chemically speaking. So it really is a lot to do with people's expectations, their perceival of symptoms. So people's pain going down, for instance, pain is an incredibly emotional, psychological kind of a symptom, perhaps even more so than chemical in many ways. So there are some symptoms that are going to be far more responsive to placebo than other things. So in that way, and we're really talking about a very small percentage of cases there, you know, is it okay, I get, you know, to use homeopathy as a placebo? You know, is there maybe some room for it there? I would still really lean towards no, because there's no reason why we can't do that through other means. But in terms of a place for homeopathy in modern medicine, I mean, we're really looking for just absolute end cases here.
So this is someone who is terminally ill, who is, you know, in pain, and they really truly believe in homeopathy, and so are getting a really nice placebo buzz from their homeopathic treatment. there's no problem with it in that situation.
Well, you know, it's, I don't really feel like I need to be the person slapping that homeopathic vial out of that person's hand necessarily, but
I really want that. I want that to be the case. I want
no,
be,
Nana.
I want there to be footage, like secret footage of you walking around hospice, just smacking homeopathic, just throwing chiropractors
out.
Or
would it be the Richard Dawkins of a palliative
care? No, you're not. But see, Richard Dawkins would just, he'd just make a snide remark and move on.
That's fine.
I want you to be the Punisher. You know what I mean? I want you to be just going in. Shirt. Your skull shirt.
I don't know if they're going to let me in into the nursing home without
just,
a tire.
Just kicking homeopathic remedies out of people's hands and shouting them. No, you die in pain, my friend.
See, here's the thing. Like, no one can deny the benefit that would come to that person if they got to use homeopathic remedies. The problem is we can never see that in isolation, because for every person for whom that happens, there's going to be the other case of someone who really does expect some kind of benefit from homeopathy when they are not going to get it, when they may get it from some other medicines.
Yeah.
And it is a bit of a, you know, to use a phrase I don't particularly like to use, I suppose, a bit of a slippery slope. If you give a lot of these untested, unproven, disproven treatments that little bit of an inch, generally speaking, they take a mile, and they never really show any inclination to kind of really limit themselves to these end extreme cases. Of course, their claims in terms of what they can do are just far greater than what we can ever realistically expect.
I mean, there would be, I'm sure there is a homeopath somewhere who is like, oh no, just use it for, you know, if you're having a bit of trouble sleeping, and I would never dream of using it, you know, in whatever situation. Yeah. But the problem is that there is no regulation, is there? There's no regulation. There's not even really a clear definition. Like, I'm sure there are homeopathic bodies that would say, you know, what they see it as. But anyone can set up shop and call themselves a homeopath and sell what they see as a homeopathic remedy and make whatever claims they want. So while we can talk about these individual cases, if you have that one person who is taking a homeopathic treatment and gets better or feels better, that's giving credence to it as an idea that is going to spread. Like that, you know, it's not going to exist. Like, it's not going to exist in that one person's experience. There's going to be the person in the next bed who's going to go, oh, homeopathy works. Well, someone said I should take it as a treatment and it's actually going to cure my cancer. I'm going to do that. Yeah. And then, you know, as an idea, as soon as you give it a credence in one setting, you then give it credence in a lot of settings.
That's exactly right. So despite the temptation to really use the example of just that one person who might benefit, is really to ignore the broader scope of these things and the repercussions it has. And you're exactly right. It really takes nothing for you to be able to call yourself a homeopath or any of the other alternative medicine arts, I suppose.
Like, you call them arts.
The dark arts. Great. That's right.
That's great. I mean, what if we just, instead of calling them alternative medicine, because that's the problem, is they get lumped in with medicine.
That's right.
What if we just call them art? We just say they're art. It's an art. It's art, and it affects you in the same way art does. It has an emotional, you know, and possibly even spiritual impact on you, but it's not doing a single thing from a medical point of view.
And you know, if they'd like to debate that definition with me, that'd be totally fine. The thing is that is not where they want to be. That is not the space they want to occupy.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, look, it sounds like what you're saying is, look, it could possibly work in this very specific cases in these, you know, and offer these very specific benefits to these very specific people because of the placebo effect.
That's right.
So basically, if we lie to these very certain, these very particular people, it's going to give them the benefit that that is claimed because they believe it.
That's right.
But the problem with that is that it is, you know, give them an inch and they take a mile. It is going to create this. Because you also have this, you know, correlation and causation thing where someone goes, oh, you know, this is acupuncture, but I was reading a book, it was a business book, and he's talking about how he, one of his clients is one of the top acupuncturists in America and works in fertility. So this is people trying to have babies, get needles poked in them, and then they're supposed to get pregnant shortly after. And he goes, this guy is one of the top fertility acupuncture experts in the world. He has found that 30% of his patients fall pregnant within 6 months of having the acupuncture treatment when used in conjunction with other fertility treatments.
Jesus.
So you have people going and going on, you know, IVF and, you know, all of the other treatments you can get for fertility, and then also going, oh, and I'm going to get some needles stuck in me as well, and then getting pregnant and saying it was the needles that did it and not all of the other treatments that I got. So it's that, I mean, this is the thing is, you know, if one of those people who's taking a homeopathic remedy feels better, but then what happens if their cancer goes into remission, goes into remission, and then they go, oh, it was the homeopathy that did it and not the chemotherapy, or just, as I understand it, cancer can sometimes go into remission.
Yeah, absolutely.
For reasons doctors can't explain.
That's right. Yeah. And so there is this huge sense of them really kind of taking credit of either things that medicine's doing or just coincidence, which is really the modus operandi of this alternative health movement as it exists. And there is just no kind of admission of this either externally or just even kind of to themselves. I mean, this is just how deep these delusions go, which is the thing that really fascinates me, which is that they're really not cheating people in the most evil way. It really begins with a bit of self-deception to themselves. Like, I, part of me believes, I'm sure that the acupuncturist who was, you know, apparently making women fertile absolutely believed what they were doing. And yet,
oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And yet it just takes nothing, almost no cognitive effort for anyone else to just see how absurdly transparent that is.
Yeah.
Using it while using other proven tested therapies. Like, it's kind of almost laughable, but it's depressing how, you know, kind of deluded this really is, which makes the discussion, the debate and the ethics of this, you know, so much more complicated, because often the people you're opposed to, who you disagree with, they're not these kind of caricatured evil characters. They're just so deluded in a very, kind of in a way that doesn't really make them morally responsible in the way we'd perhaps like them to as villains.
Yeah.
And it makes it difficult, but it also, you know, perhaps it calls for the fact that we need a bit more, I guess, you know, compassion in the debate at times, but sometimes you need to be ruthless.
Yeah. People also seek out alternative medicines and things like homeopathy because not just because it hasn't worked, but because they feel more of a connection and more of a sense that they're going to get an effective treatment from this more romantic idea of treatment, the idea that it's natural, the idea that it's, you know, holistic, and science-based medicine cannot give them what they want as a patient, because what they want as a patient is something natural and special and magical, and they're not going to get that from, you know, like a suppository. Well, they might.
I don't know.
I haven't
haven't tried them all, Nick.
I haven't had a suppository. It could be a transcendental experience. So how do you combat that? When you are presented with people who want magic, who want mystery, who want nature, and you are a guy with a prescription pad and a you know, warm left hand, like what, you know, like how do you deal with that? Because yeah. I have, you know, do people like yourself need to start setting up, you know, GP practices that feel like, you know, they were, you know, with dream catchers in the window and salt lamps in the corner, and do they need to buy into what those people want?
That's a really interesting question, and it really calls into question, well, how far should we go? Where is the demarcation line beyond which we shouldn't step? Like, what are our real goals? Is my goal to convert this person from one system of thinking to a more rational one? Or is my responsibility as a doctor to merely just get to them to the best health possible? Mm-hmm. Or is it to just present the truth to them and let them pick whatever they want and respect their autonomy? And this is the big ethical dilemma that we're in, because prioritizing any one of those ethical principles over another does not necessarily guarantee the same results. So,
because I want all of them. I want everyone to be rational. I want everyone to be healthy, and I want everyone to get the, you know, to be presented with the truth. That's what I want. I want all of those things, and I want them now.
Yeah, and it is nearly impossible for me to achieve in a 15 to 20 minute appointment. It's what makes this job incredibly difficult. So the kind of person you describe, the people who have these broader belief systems in which their homeopathy or Reiki, whatever, is rooted, they're the most challenging patients to deal with in order to try and persuade them towards a more evidence-based treatment. It's incredibly difficult. The okay cases, the ones who've just heard, oh, look, I've heard homeopathy might work for my XYZ. Do you think that's true? And those patients are usually actually quite amenable to laying out factual information in an effective way. But essentially what's happening is with patients who have their beliefs in alternative medicines rooted in much deeper beliefs about the natural world and fallacies about how natural things are good or beliefs that are much more deeply cultural and religious, is, you know, all you're really doing if you just lay out facts for these people is, you know, they're sitting on a chair almost from which they've got formed their particular worldview, and you pull out one leg of the chair and the chair might be wobbling, but they'll do their best to balance. Or if not, or if you really go out of your way to show how homeopathy is completely not effective, it's not really long until they latch on to the next thing that kind of comes along, and they replace that leg of the chair with, I don't know, like a stack of books or whatever it is.
And then you become the jerk who keeps stealing their chair legs.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And what happens then is then they stop coming back to you. And that has two bad outcomes. The first one is you are far less likely to be able to offer them an evidence-based treatment. And the second one, and this is interesting, is they stop coming back to you as a business. Now, I know that sounds, you know, quite greedy and evil, etc., but I just want to lay out for people how the incentives are quite misaligned in that way. Like, I have every incentive in many ways to just go with what they're saying and not really interrupt the flow of their logic and their misbeliefs about how things work, and just kind of go, yeah, totally, yeah, do the Reiki, etc., whatever it is, and either give them medication that works, and if I can't persuade them, that's totally okay, you kind of keep coming back to me. It's like the incentives are just aligned for me to follow the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily the path that's going to guarantee the best health.
Yeah.
And does this necessarily align with giving the person the most autonomy? Well, it respects their choices. It certainly doesn't respect the concept of their informed choice, because you might not be informing them. Mm. So we're constantly treading this line. What do? Do you tell them the most truth? Do you try to do the thing that's going to optimize their health the most? Do you give them the most choice possible? And it's this continual kind of challenge. And I think that challenge on a patient-by-patient basis has got very variable results. It's very difficult, which is why talking about it in a much more kind of public health way and talking about it outside the consultation rooms, I think it's probably going to have far more impact in terms of persuading people towards and away from things they should or should not be pursuing that are going to give them better or worse health outcomes.
That, I mean, yeah, it's something, because I just wrote an article for my blog, which is like the worst way to start a sentence. I just wrote
on
an article.
On my blog, yeah. On my blog. Go on. I'm curious to see how the sentence ends.
Yeah.
How are you going to redeem yourself?
I just solved all of the world's problems in my blog. Mm-hmm. I wrote a blog post about buying gripe water. So my daughter, Edie, who's 2 months old, has gas. So she's like big fat stomach. And I'm going, well, what do we do?
Sure.
And someone said gripe water. And I had heard of it. And I went, oh, great, look it up. And you Google it. And it literally, like, first line of Wikipedia is like, no, it's just not a thing. Sure. It was invented by a guy in the 1850s. And it's just random shit in a bottle. That's my random shit in a bottle gripe water by Nicholas J. Johnson is on sale now. And so I kind of went, oh, okay, it doesn't work. But I would go to, I talked to my doctor, who kind of just handballed, like, just kind of deflected from the question and said, oh, I don't really deal with children. And then the maternal nurse, the person from the council was, saying, well, it's an alternative remedy that a lot of parents try, but, wow. No one was lying. And then finally it was Chemist Warehouse, who were like the dodgiest chemist, I think, of, the chains of chemists in Australia that will sell anything. And the poor pharmacist, I'm going, okay, gripe water, what's the deal? My daughter has, like gas, I want it, something that's going to work. Is this going to work? Does this work? And she's like, well, some parents swear by it, but it is an alternative medicine. And it's, she goes, look, there is not a, and then I said, so what is the non-alternative medicine? What's the one with the empirical science? She goes, well, there isn't one. And I said, so there's no empirical evidence that this actually works. And she says, the studies, and she got really flustered, and she started kind of looking around, and I realized it was this thing of you're talking about, that it's not just that she doesn't want to offend my beliefs or that she's trying to be open-minded. It's that all of these people's jobs rely on not offending my personal beliefs. And once they all kind of got that I had looked it up and saw that it was bullshit,
yep.
were quite happy to sort of subtly admit that, yes, it was. Yeah. But none of them were prepared to go, no, that's crap.
That's such a beautiful story. It really.
Thank you. I'm glad that, you know, my blog post touched you in that way.
You know what? It did. And it really did, because it really validates my experience all the time in the clinic. It's funny how... on one hand, I can be and am very outspoken about alternative medicines, and yet in the clinic, I soften, just like all those practitioners you mentioned. Maybe not to the same extent, but I feel myself softening, and it's not just to do with not causing offense. It's a bit of everything. It's a bit of all the factors that you've just mentioned, and but I tell you what, when the patients, you know, do the firm thing and just ask me the question, look. So, is there evidence that this antibiotic is going to help my cold? The wave of relief that washes over me is just amazing. And I can just be honest and say, no, I have no evidence to do this. And suddenly all the negotiations and prevarications and all the fudging and all the softness can just kind of go away. And it's fascinating how it really is the patient who can, if we take the lead there, when you really want to be the one who asks that firm question, it really pulls all the rest of us health practitioners into line. But I mean, that gripe water thing, as you said, gripe water, you know, I had this reaction inside me, which was, I don't know what this gripe water is. I literally reached for my phone to see, like, what is this gripe water thing? Is he going to ask me? Does it work out? And the honest response is going to be, I don't know. I don't even know what it is.
It's sodium bicarbonate and herbs.
Yeah. And
that's it. Yeah. And sometimes alcohol.
Wow. Well, that's...
Babies like their liquor.
I'm sure they do. And it's, yeah, you also don't want to be the doctor who says... You know, I don't know if any evidence that it works. And then, you know, it turns out, you know, a year ago in, you know, in six journals, someone said there may be some evidence. Like, it's, you know, you don't want to be that guy either, which is why a lot of the admission of ignorance can just be so soft a lot of the time. But, you know, one of the best questions I think a patient can ask a doctor is there evidence for X? And it may be a cognitively difficult question to answer, but I promise you the relationship that you will set up with your doctor will just be so much better. And if in any way it makes your relationship worse, that's really probably not the doctor to go to, as far as I'm concerned.
Could you set up at the beginning, you know, like if someone comes in with mental health problems, they do a mental health check and they, or you ask, you know, first when they first become a patient, it's like a smoking, pregnant, history of whatever. Could you have a questionnaire that you could ask people that's basically a belief, something that you can then sort of see what they're interested in, what they believe in, what they, you know, not like, do you think homeopathy is good? Or because you could have someone who just legitimately believes that it has been scientifically proven and has no idea that it's not.
Yes.
But just some questions you can ask that would just suss out the type of person they are. So you can hit them, you know, if it's someone like me and I'd come in and you can just start hitting me with facts and I can go away happy.
Yeah.
Or if it's someone you need to tread more carefully about. Like, is that something doctors could do to help their patients so they know what type of, you know, what type of medical experience they want?
See, that's reasonable to an extent in that the only kind of patients that helps my interactions with is someone like you who legitimately wants... the evidence.
Yeah.
If on the other hand, if you get anyone else who identifies them as kind of otherwise, it still does not necessarily help me find the right answer in terms of what to do for them. But for the person who's wants an absolute clear-cut evidence-based answer every time, if there was a way that they could self-identify, we could identify them, yeah, absolutely, that would make things easier. There's this exception. People can say they want evidence, and yet I'd say a lot of us, and I'll lump myself in this as well, may have a few blind spots, hold a couple of beliefs that we make kind of excuses for, but that just absolutely aren't kind of evidence-based in any way.
Yep.
Which is, so even with that group who elect themselves as very, you know, kind of pro-evidence in that way, there might still be blind spots there too, which makes it so difficult, because that's the thing about a lot of these I guess, cognitive biases and false belief systems is, you know, you, by definition, you think you're right.
You know, I've had people who are very, very, you know, I hate homeopathy. I just hate it. And they're very critical of it. And then we'll turn around and be quite happy to talk about the chiropractor that they go to.
Totally.
Chiropractor, as far as I know, there was some suggestion that maybe it's good if you've got a bit of a bad back.
Mm.
But apparently even that is, there's no real, it just feels nice to have someone crack your back.
Yeah. And again, which would be fine if that's the only claim they made. I if you want to feel nice about your back and they're not going to do extensive spinal manipulation, by all means, go for it. But exactly right. There's level B evidence for lower back pain, simple mechanical lower back pain.
So what's level B?
So there's just several levels of evidence in terms of the how conclusive the studies were, how many different publications there were over, etc. And we can just broadly say, yeah, there's decent evidence that it can cause some temporarily medium-term pain relief in back pain. But it does not help with asthma. It does not help with, you know, MS and a range of other claims that chiropractors can kind of make. Sorry, I'm just going on this chiropractor rant here. The point you're trying to make.
I don't know. I rarely have a point on this thing. I'm just trying to get you to say something inflammatory about chiropractors.
Oh, man.
The problem is, though, that for every chiropractor, you know, you could say, oh, there are chiropractors who say it cures asthma. And then people go and ask their chiropractor and they say, oh, no, that's those renegades. No, I don't believe that. And people would sigh relief and then go back to getting, you know, treatment for their athlete's foot from their chiropractor.
That is exactly it. There's this very selective form of skepticism that people can apply and then use almost like as an emblem of just how kind of wise they really are and really advertise that point, which really lulls, I think, patients into this false sense of security, and it's really dangerous. You can't be skeptical enough of your health practitioners, including GPs. I mean,
well, so let's be skeptical of you then, as a GP.
Sure,
you are someone who, like you said, you're making money from them.
Correct.
So it's in your interest to keep them as a patient and tell them what they want to hear, which is, you know, obviously dishonest.
Yes.
And also, though, you are being, you know, presented with new medications constantly from large pharmaceutical companies that will, you know, send you on ski trips and give you free pens. And there are people whose job it is to go around who know nothing about medicine, but they know everything about sales. And their job is to convince you to be writing prescriptions. Every doctor I go into, they have little things all over their desks with the names of the latest, greatest product all over there. So even if you are at least someone who is a chiropractor or a homeopath or any of those people, they are not in the pocket of big chiropractor. You know, they are there. They are plying their trade. They do not have these giant billionaire, billion-dollar companies behind them pushing them out there. Most of the time, they're on their own. They're making their own stuff. They're doing their own thing. You know, there are companies, you know, there are large companies like Swiss, for example, out there.
Yeah, which is incredibly problematic. Yeah.
You know, which is problematic. But that is, Swiss are simply using the same business structure as all the big pharmaceutical companies that have bought you.
Bought me out. Bought, I know. You out. Damn, you really busted me here.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting on that big pharma payout, by the way, which still keep checking for come. Mails. And
but, okay, but mail, what do you say? Gonna, I mean, what do you say to that? How? What is your reaction to those claims to when people say that to you? I mean, I don't know if they do, but
yeah. I don't deny a lot of those things at all. I mean, I guess I will lead by saying that Australia's really leading the way in terms of trying to eliminate that that big pharma influence as much as possible, and it's getting tighter and tighter every day. So a few of those things you mentioned earlier, for example, you know, the big ski trips, etc., that's something that legitimately used to happen and basically just does not happen very much now. There is an increasing, I guess, clamping down on conferences, etc., and this and that kind of stuff. So things are getting firmer and firmer and tighter on us as doctors. And not just that, I think doctors' awareness of these things is improving as well. We used to really have this belief amongst us that the most educated doctors, we wouldn't fall prey to this big pharma advertising models. And yet the research shows continually that we do. And so everything from free lunches at hospital meetings to any kind of overseas conference sponsoring, et cetera, is something that's just been kind of drastically reduced all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, my God, it's nowhere near as flagrant as it is in the United States. That said, I will absolutely admit with you that big pharmaceutical companies' influence definitely plays a part in influencing our decisions. But here's the kind of key thing. We acknowledge that there's a problem with incentives and biases. And you've surely got to trust, just maybe slightly, millimetrically more, the practitioner who admits that they might be prey to these biases than the ones that seem to say they've kind of found the Holy Grail in their particular disciplines. Mm-hmm. And this is just not something we do in medicine. We have this thing called, you know, kind of like the half-life of facts that occurs in a lot of disciplines. And from the first day in medicine, where at most medical schools you're told that by the time you graduate, you know, half of what you're told will be outdated or being proven completely wrong. We just don't know which half. So there is this constant emphasis on being skeptical, kind of off your own knowledge, and if everything you're getting from, say, drug companies or even the things that you take for granted in textbooks, and just knowing that these are probably not definitive answers. They might not be completely wrong, but they're probably going to be, you know, kind of superseded at some point. And to that extent, I think the most anyone can expect from any health practitioner, be a homeopath or a Reiki artist or a surgeon or a GP, is that they do the best possible job with the best possible information that's available at the time. There's no much more that you can expect from anyone else.
I guess that's it, is that a good GP is interested in what is the correct answer to the problem, and that is it. And they're prepared to accept, previously we thought it was X, but now we think the answer is most likely to be Y.
That's right.
Which is annoying, but that is what it's about. So everything you have learned in medical school and in your time in the third season of Scrubs and all of that could be thrown, like you could throw, you'd be more than happy to throw all of that away the moment you were told, you were presented with the evidence that it was wrong.
Totally.
And presented with new evidence. So you're more about the philosophy or the idea of empirical science as opposed to what the facts are. Whereas a homeopathy practitioner is, they are invested in the idea that diluting, you know, caffeine in a swimming pool's worth of water is, you know, putting a drop on your tongue is going to send you to sleep.
That's right. And even within the last few years, there are so many things in my own practice that I've had to stop completely. And
like what? What is something? Can you give me an example?
Yeah, sure. So let me have a quick think. So the example that comes to mind, okay, straight away, and there's probably more I'll think of in a second, is irritable bowel syndrome. So that used to be what we call a diagnosis of exclusion, which is to say that you can't say you've got irritable bowel syndrome until you've made sure that it's not any of the other 19 things on the list. And only then you can say it's irritable bowel syndrome. And what would happen as a consequence is people would be put through several rounds of blood tests and quite often a colonoscopy and a gastroscopy, which are kind of invasive surgical procedures that put people through risks as well. And it used to be you could not do that until you made sure that there was nothing wrong in a colonoscopy and gastroscopy. And that gave doctors a lot of comfort because you've got these patients with these symptoms. You can't really explain what's going on. Could it be cancer? I don't know. Maybe it could be cancer. We better do a colonoscopy or a gastroscopy to make sure it's not cancer. Oh, great, it's not cancer. They've got irritable bowel syndrome. And yet the research just showed that none of these people who we were putting through these scopes, we were able to diagnose cancers in. And we really had to check ourselves and go, hold on, stop. Stop ordering these tests. They're potentially causing a lot of problems, perhaps even deaths. And, you know, as doctors, you have to get over this irrational fear that these people have got cancers, etc., and be a bit more comfortable with just making the diagnosis with the patient, saying, I don't really think we need to put you through those tests. You've got irritable bowel syndrome. And that's completely misaligned with the incentives of gastroenterologists. They are now making legitimately less money by not putting these people through tests. And by telling people this test is not going to advantage you at all, I'm missing out on a few thousand dollars here by not doing this test, but it's in your best interest to not have this test. And so kind of we had to put aside our fears. Specialists had to put aside their financial incentives to do the right thing here and say, you just do not need to do this test. You have this syndrome. There's other cheaper, more conservative ways we can manage this.
Does that come a lot like with something like irritable bowel syndrome, because a syndrome is not like there isn't a thing in the body you can test for. Like a syndrome is essentially you have all of you have these symptoms and we're going to put all these symptoms into one category and we'll call it a syndrome. And then now you have this syndrome and we know that people who follow these things, you know, the syndrome gets better or worse. But it's not like a virus where you can test and you go, oh, look, the stick turned blue, you have irritable bowel syndrome. And that, so it's something where you, that's what you mean by it's by exclusion in that you, when you have, you know, as soon as they walk in, you go, well, you have all of the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome and you were testing for every possible thing that's wrong, rather than going, you probably just got irritable bowel syndrome.
That's right. So now instead of testing for 20 things, we test for, you know, the common five or six things, so to speak.
Is that, wait, is that when people go on the FODMAPs diet when they have
irritable bowel?
Yes. Oh, I, no, give me a, I would rather you can put a camera up my bum rather than make me eat bloody FODMAPs diet.
And we offer patients that choice and we have a very honest discussion with them about these things. So
do you want eating nothing but potatoes and chicken or a camera up your bum?
And if you want that, I can make that happen for you.
For the very low, low price.
That's right. So
I suddenly understand why homeopathy is so like, wait, I can have some herbs or I can have a camera at my bum or totally. I can only eat chicken.
Do you know, another example that comes to mind is, and this is, man, this is a battle I have to fight on a daily basis. And it's far more to do with me than the patients, is patients who've got bronchitis. Bronchitis is essentially the symptoms people present with will be a bit of cough, bit of fever. And as the physician, you get the idea that this is an infective illness. It's not a full-blown pneumonia yet, but it's pretty bad. And classically, the treatment has been, well, if you think it's bacterial, give antibiotics. And yet, all the studies have indicated over the last quite a few years that even when it's due to a bacteria in bronchitis, giving antibiotics has marginal benefits at best, probably no benefits, probably more harm than good because of side effects. And you constantly have to check yourself and the patient, because the patients have, they've taken time out of their schedule to come see you. You're running half an hour late as usual as a doctor, and they've come to ask for treatment. And you kind of basically have to go through this negotiation of, well, yes, and even if it is bacterial, antibiotics, they're just not going to help you. And patients really walk out more or less empty handed. Sure, with a few kind of mild symptomatic treatments, but not much else going on. And yet the data for this is just so completely incontrovertible that antibiotics are not going to help and it's just going to cause a lot more harm. And yet I would say antibiotic prescribing for bronchitis has probably gone down a lot in 5 to 10 years. Again, completely not aligned with our instincts to do something for the patient, not aligned with our financial incentives. If you do things that patients like, they will keep coming back to you. But it's a line you constantly have to negotiate. And I'll happily admit, often I'll fold. As well, sometimes I will end up prescribing out of, and there's various factors there at play, but yeah, there's this constant negotiation, you know, within ourselves as doctors and with the patients going on, where you try to do the thing that's right and fight the incentives that are aligned for you to do the wrong thing.
That's so depressing. You're supposed to. This is why people go to homeopathists. Is that you just
you
come
know
in
what
here
you're gonna get? You know, 100% guarantee you're gonna get bullshit.
Yeah, I know. But you're coming in with your shades of grey.
I know.
Maybe kind of wanna. This is. I said it. I want certainty. Damn it. No, I never said that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate your candor as well. I think that is. It is good to have a doctor who, like you said, is upfront about what they don't know. Which is, I feel though that I now know less at the end of this conversation than I did at the beginning. And that must mean you're a very good doctor. If people want to find out, you do a lot of different stuff. But if people want to read, because you write a lot of articles and interesting stuff for the general public, for lay people, where's the best place to find all of those? Have you got one place where you've put them all, or should we just follow you on Twitter?
So look, best thing you can do, I think, is follow me on Twitter at Dr. Vyom, Drvyom. Or you can literally Google me and find my website. I'm very shortly about to put up, by the time this podcast goes to air, I'm about to put a link up to my Medium page where I put on all my writing on any and all things health related and some non-health related things too. And generally I'll get things published in a few newspapers. So I guess you keep an eye out for it in all those places.
Awesome. Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for the talk.
Thanks for the time. Cheers.